put on by the UConn section of the University of Canada North. And my name is Garth Graham. I'm the chairman of the UConn section of the University of Canada North, and I'm going to also chair this panel discussion this evening. I suspect that we still have some confusion on CBC with an Anik ad advertising things at 7:30, but we're starting at just a few minutes late. The starting time is 7 o'clock, and the starting time for the next two forums will be 7 o'clock as well. I'd also like to indicate that the next one will be at the UConn Indian Center, and the last one will be back at F.H. Collins. And the reason you have all these route signs this evening directing you to the darker regions of the school is because we ran into a conflict with the double booking of the cafeteria where we had intended to be, but we wound up here. But presumably the fourth one, Rob, will be back in the cafeteria?
We hope so.
Very good. The first session that we had last week, just to recap for people who weren't here, was putting land claims into context, and it dealt with the international, national, and local perspectives on self-determination and Aboriginal rights. Tonight, we would like to deal with the land claims process in the Yukon. And this isn't so much the content of land claim settlements, but the way in which it's decided what the content of a land claim settlement will be. And we have three panelists this evening, and I'll introduce each of them in turn as it's time for them to speak. And we had hoped to have a fourth panelist from CYI, but we only have one representative of CYI here this evening. To lead off, I'd like to introduce Mr. Wally Greiba, who is with the Federal Native Claims Office. And I probably haven't got the title exactly right, but away you go, Wally.
Thank you very much, Garth. That's close enough for government work, as they say, for the introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure for me to be here on behalf of Dr. John Naismith, my colleague in the business of attempting to resolve with the Council for Yukon Indians and the territorial government the matter of the Yukon Indian claim. Just as a bit of background, it's probably appropriate for me to mention that John and I, along with two or three others, are also involved with comprehensive claims north of 60 generally, which means, of course, the Cope claim in the Western Arctic, the Mackenzie District claim of the Métis and the Dene of the Mackenzie District, and the Eastern Arctic claim put forward by Inuit Taparitsat of Canada, as well as a claim that is emerging slowly but surely in Newfoundland Labrador. So our involvement north of 60 is somewhat extensive, and the reason I mention that broad background is that of all of those claims, the Yukon Indian claim has progressed in our perspective further and more substantially than any of the others. And as a matter of stated policy, the federal government views the native claim in the Yukon as being a number one priority, one which we are going to and are devoting a great deal of effort towards resolving in an equitable and hopefully a satisfactory manner. I think it would be appropriate for me to just put a little bit of historical perspective on our process, which is the subject we're going to be talking about. And in so doing, I would refer to a report in 1898 of the Yukon Detachment of the Northwest Mounted Police, which reported a number of things. One of them was that 7,080 boats had traveled north on the Yukon River that year, carrying approximately 28,600 prospectors and miners. At their destination, the junction of the Klondike and Yukon Rivers, there was situated an Indian fishing camp of 20 families. By 1899, the camp had given way to a city with a population between 15,000 and 20,000 people. 2 years before, the inspector of the Northwest Mounted Police and acting government agent for the Yukon reported in a letter to the Secretary of the Interior, and I quote, that arrangements have been made with the Indians at Klondike with the knowledge and approval of their missionaries, whereby they relinquish any claim so far as the department is concerned to the site of the old Indian village at Klondike and are now located on a point about 3 miles below the site of Dawson. To this bit of history, one could add the footnote to the effect that the Indians were no doubt camped at the mouth of the Klondike in the first place and not 3 miles downriver, because they figured that was where the best fishing was, and having had some 30,000 years to check it out before the white man arrived, they were probably right. Except for the abandoned and the upturned gravel beds that most of us have seen on Bonanza and El Dorado Creeks, there's now very little evidence of the drama which unfolded during that period of Yukon's history. And today, the Yukon is about to embark on another very large project, the largest of its kind ever to take place in Canada. Of course, that is the Northern Natural Gas Pipeline. And the question facing us, speaking from the federal perspective, is, are we prepared to make sure at this time that the terms are more equitable for the Indian people and that the government fulfills its obligations and meets its commitments? Or will the Indian people again be confronted with a move down the river? The obvious answer, one that I'm sure I don't need to mention, is of course that in this 20th century, and with the benefit of history, we hope that we can be a little bit more equitable, because hopefully we've learned at least what not to do. I raise the subject of the pipeline only to put a perspective on a question that has occurred to us frequently and has been raised with us fairly frequently. And that is that somehow there is a feeling abroad that perhaps the pipeline issue is greater than that of the Yukon Indian claim. And superficially, I suppose that could be the case. People could think that. But from our point of view, we feel that the impact of a settlement of the Yukon Indian claim will be much broader, not only for the Indian people, but for Yukon people generally, than the impact of the pipeline. Because the Yukon Indian claim embodies the aspirations and the feelings and the attitudes of a quarter of the Yukon population. And its resolution, obviously, will then serve a wide spectrum of the Indian people's needs, including education and cultural and social and economic matters, and an opportunity to participate in political and social activities. And when settled, this claim will probably, we feel, be a stabilizing force rather than a disruptive or destabilizing force, which will benefit the entire Yukon community. Turning to the process, there's no question that the advent of the pipeline and indeed of any other major development would add to the complexity of the claims process itself. However, I think that it should be absolutely clear on just what it is that we are about in attempting to resolve the Yukon Indian claim, because if we're clear on that, I think we'll recognize that that the priority that I've stated that the federal government places on resolving the claim is greater than it is on any other activity that may be going on at this time. And I think what is important to note when I start talking about process is that I'm sure this has been said before, that we're not viewing the settlement of the land claim in the Yukon as specifically a land claim, which is sort of a real estate transaction with some dollars thrown in. This entire process that we are involved with is geared towards something much broader than that, the recognition and the, or at least the identification and the accommodation of special rights that Indian people may have. It certainly is not a device of relegating the Indian people off to the back 40 to pursue only traditional pursuits such as hunting, trapping, and fishing. It is an effort to improve the means, the channels for participation in social and cultural and economic life of the Yukon. And it is certainly not an effort to assimilate Indian people, as some people have implied that the federal government might be trying to do. There is a danger in talking about the process that because of pressures due to large projects and other events, a quick fix sort of mentality might emerge, and as a result there would be some sort of an effort to do what you might call a quick and dirty settlement, which might look good at first but prove to be deficient in the future, and certainly that is not in our plans. What we want to do is make sure that we have a sound settlement that looks forward over the horizon of time and assures that Yukon Indian people and Yukoners generally are indeed satisfied, or as satisfied as they can be, with the settlement many years down the trail as well as at the present time. What we've done in the Yukon is we've tried to avoid a confrontation type of approach to solving the Yukon Indian claim. It has often been said that negotiation is what we're about, and certainly to some extent that is true. When you get to the specifics of various elements of the claim, without question there will be negotiation. But what we really are trying to do, the three principles in the claim process, namely the Council for Yukon Indians, the Yukon Territorial Government, and the Government of Canada, is to work on a cooperative planning process, which I'm sure you've heard about, and which is, I suppose, a bit of a new departure, because implicit in the cooperative planning process is to drop the confrontation approach. What is also implicit in that process is as much openness as is possible to have, so that the public at large, Indian and those who are not Indians and who are not specifically at the table, can appreciate what is going on, who is saying what to whom, and on what basis. It's forums like this, of course, and others that have been held and I'm sure will be held in the future that will assist in this openness. We aren't about making deals under the table in this process. What we have, we feel, is a unique approach, because what we are able to do in the cooperative planning process is to have the three parties, whom I've mentioned, deal with the various issues involved in the claim openly and without prejudice, and having explored every possible avenue that can be found to realize the objectives implicit in the resolution of the claim, take those hopefully mutually agreed to, or perhaps disagreed to by partners' ideas, those recommendations, back to our executive levels, which in the case of the CYI would be their Board of Directors and General Assembly, in the federal case, the Federal Cabinet, and in the Territorial Government's case, the Executive Committee, and put before the executive level the best thinking that we at the Planning Council table have been able to devote to a particular area of the claim, along with options for perhaps sometimes negotiation or political resolution of points that we may not be able to resolve at the Planning Council table. But the significant point is this, that we have, in the cooperative planning process, attempted to separate the political, the executive level from a level where frank, open exchanges without prejudice can be carried on, and which can hopefully draw down on the best available experience and expertise to develop alternatives for resolving the claim. To do that, one of our main instruments is the formation of working groups, as we call them. These are working groups comprised of people who have particular specialties and knowledge in various areas. And these working groups, who operate under the direction of the Planning Council generally, are charged with the responsibility for collecting data, for developing background documents, for conducting research, and producing recommendations and suggestions, which then the Planning Council can consider on each claim element. The groups comprise of representatives from each of the parties at the Planning Council table. However, all of the participants are free to draw down on resource people from within their respective organizations as they see fit, and indeed from the community at large, if that seems to be appropriate. And that then gives the Planning Council the broadest possible input from all levels that will enable, in turn, the Planning Council, in a freewheeling and in a relatively informal way, to debate the various elements of the claim and hopefully develop those recommendations to which I have referred to present to their respective executive levels, and thereby hopefully achieve a reasonable resolution of each of the points. Now, the other major feature of the process is that, in addition to removing sort of the secrecy and the adversarial approach to the resolution of the claim, we also have agreed to treat the elements of the claim in a sequential way. And by that I mean that we don't have to wait for all 13 or 14 elements of the claim to be at a particular point in time before we move forward another step. This is very important because there are certain elements of the claim which can be dealt with relatively quickly. For example, we have already agreed and issued a Planning Council document on the eligibility element, which establishes very clearly, and by the way, accepts the Yukon Indian people's interpretation of who is eligible to be a participant in the benefits of the claim. That is in place. It has been looked at by the executive levels of all three parties and is there, so we know who we are dealing with. That's just one example. On the other hand, on some of the other elements, such as quantity of cash settlement or land and so on, there's a great deal of work still to do. And in any event, that work that has to be done has not impeded our resolving the eligibility question as an example. There are other things that we have agreed to. Another document, for example, that we've put forward is a document called the Settlement Model. Document number 4 of the Planning Council, which in effect lays out the bare bones of a potential agreement in principle on the Yukon Indian claim. Now, it is by no means complete, and it has many elements of it that are not defined clearly at all because they have not yet been resolved. But it is a step forward. It's a sequential step forward. It indicates not only to those who are participating in the discussion, but to the public at large, how some of these important elements might look a little further down the trail. And so the sequential nature of the process of cooperative planning, we feel is at least as important as the fact that we have been able to open it up and make the whole process more visible, more accessible to the public at large. I think I've gone about as far as I care to go on the cooperative planning process at the moment. I think that the only thing I might say in conclusion is to re-emphasize again that we are attempting by all means possible, and despite various delays or pauses that are occasioned by perfectly natural events, to move forward in resolving the Yukon Indian claim in an open and in a sequential way, a way that will be understandable to the public, and understandable, more importantly perhaps, to those who are going to be the ultimate beneficiaries or victims of the resolution of the claim. The Canadian government, as you know, has taken considerable pains to deal with this matter seriously. I am absolutely confident that we will continue to do that. I'm encouraged, as we all are from the federal side, with the understanding and the cooperation of the other parties at the table. Discussions in the cooperative planning process have been very frank, very open, certainly not inhibited, and it's my opinion, the opinion of my colleague John Naismith, that if we can continue with this process the way that we're going and continue to hold the interest of persons such as yourselves who take time out to find out what's going on, that we will, in fact, resolve the claim through cooperative planning to the basic satisfaction of not only the citizens of Yukon, but the citizens of Canada as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Wally. For you people standing up at the back, there's some chairs up front here. Perhaps you'd like to take this opportunity to come up and sit down. Now I'd like to turn the panel to Dr. Art Pearson, the Commissioner of the Yukon.
Thank you, Garth. First of all, I would like to congratulate you and your manager, Mr. Hornsey, for putting together a session of four information packages on the Yukon Native Land Claim. I think that when the idea was originally broached, it fit in very well with the concept that we all had with regard to the cooperative planning process. And that is to make people more aware of what's going on, to have more participation so that when we're finished with the land claim, when we reach an agreement, it will have more acceptability and more applicability to the Yukon scene. First of all, I think I should make the Yukon Territorial Government position very clear, and that is that we still consider a just and lasting settlement of the Yukon Indian land claim as the most important issue facing the Yukon and our future. And without a just and equitable land claim settlement, we see many difficulties in moving forward together as Yukoners and determining just where we feel the Yukon should go. Now, I can't tell you any more about the planning process than Mr. Greiba has already told you, really. He's gone through the background pretty well, the old format of hard negotiation where you lock yourselves in the closeted room and you pound out various issues and try to reach an agreement. And this system is outmoded and outdated and certainly not well suited to something as important and as broad and as general as a land claim, which will ultimately determine, I think, just what the Yukon will be and where the Yukon will go in the future. The old negotiation stance of quid pro quo, you give me something, I'll give you something, just isn't the way to settle the future of a race of people or a group of people who want to work together to make the Yukon a better place for everybody to live. So, in place of that closeted technique, the cooperative planning process was one that was suggested and one that we supported strongly. It represents, as you've been told, frank, open discussion. It's one that hopefully will not involve the secrecy. It will produce information. We already have produced four documents, and that may not sound like very much in terms of 1 year's work, or most of a year anyway, but in terms of what the public has seen prior to that 1 year, starting in 1973, I think it's a pretty good track record. And for those of you who don't have the four Planning Council documents, I would suggest that you contact Wally's office. I think they're available, are they not, Wally? They talk about the beneficiaries, who will be eligible under a settlement. They talk about the goals and the objectives, and they talk about the elements, or they, for the first time, put in the open some of the elements that we at this stage anyway consider important in settlement of a land claim. Now, the territorial government takes a position at the table because this is not the traditional claim that will involve money and land only. There are beneficiaries and there are non-beneficiaries, or recipients and non-recipients under this claim. And regardless of those who actually derive the spoils, shall we call them, of the claim, these will affect every individual in this room and all Yukoners. And thus, there has to be somebody, there has to be a group of people who discuss this openly and frankly, recognizing the realities of such a claim being superimposed upon a group of people who all rightfully consider Yukon their home and are most interested in it. Mr. Kretchen, when he was Minister of the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs, stated in 1973 that the participation of respective provincial or territorial governments in the negotiating process is viewed as a basic requirement to a successful and lasting result. And this simply recognized that here in the Yukon anyway, and the claim that we're discussing, there are a number of residents, many residents, who will not be beneficiaries under any claim, but who are committed to the Yukon. The Yukon is their home for one or two, or even I guess there are third generation Yukoners who will not be recipients under this land claim. And their interests must be acknowledged and must be represented, and thus the territorial government tries to represent those people and all Yukoners truly at the table. Now if we look at the goals, there are three goals, and only one of those goals, goal number two, really concerns itself with the traditional claim, land and money. Claim, or goals number one and goals number three are mostly concerned with programs of nature that will allow the Indian people or encourage the Indian people to participate in the various elements of Yukon society, to contribute to those elements and to receive benefits under them. Now under the Yukon Act, you probably all know that the territorial government has certain powers devolved unto it, and programs such as education, health, game, wildlife management are responsibilities that have by legislation been devolved to the Yukon territorial government. And as such, for settlement or alteration of any of the current policies under any of these program areas, the information must be presented to the Yukon Legislative Assembly for their consideration and their approval. The creation of things like game advisory councils, new methods for the Indian people to participate in the management of wildlife, the harvest of fishes, and the harvest of forests, and this type of thing. These are all areas that the Indian people rightfully want to participate in, and many of them must be presented to the Legislative Assembly for their consideration and implementation under ordinances that they control. The territorial government participates by having a representative participate fully at the Planning Council. We are then represented on all of the working committees, or whatever working committee we feel we have an interest in and can contribute to. At the table, the government is represented by myself and usually one other elected member of the executive committee. We are backed up by two members, staff members of a land claim unit in the government. Material from the Planning Council is discussed, frankly, at the table. Position papers are worked out, taken back to the Executive Committee for deliberation and discussion as a group, and hopefully ratification. If changes are to be made, they're brought back from the Executive Committee back to the Planning Council for further discussion, and thus an equitable position is reached. The Legislative Assembly, at this stage, is represented by the presence of an elected member of the Executive Committee at the Planning Council. They also have their own standing committee on Indian land claims, and they as well try to communicate information and positions to the public by holding public hearings and having people like myself, like Dr. Naismith, and others who are involved appear before them to undergo questioning and to disseminate information. At this stage, when there is no change in the legislation required, the Legislative Assembly is not directly involved other than through the members on the Executive Committee. We believe that the success of the land claim in the Yukon will not depend only on what is received by the Indian people under the settlement, but whether what is received will be viewed and accepted in good faith and with goodwill among all Yukoners. We feel that if they don't, if the settlement is not received in good faith and with goodwill, then all of the material things in the world will do the Indian people no good whatsoever. They must be viewed, and the settlement must be viewed as a positive contributing force to the future of the Yukon. It must be viewed and accepted that the Indian people will then contribute and participate in every aspect of the Yukon's future. And I think it's very difficult for any of us here today to think that we and we alone could carry on and dictate where the Yukon should go, what philosophy we should carry forward. Should it be an all-out development philosophy? Should it be a conservation philosophy? Should it be a mixed philosophy? And truly, I know of no country in the world that should try or can try to make those decisions successfully when you may have as many as 30% of your population who are outside the system and not contributing. The Indian people have a great heritage and a great connection with the land, with the wildlife, and I believe firmly that their contributions should contribute a great deal to the future of the Yukon after a land claim. I hope much more than they are able to contribute now in the present situation. I don't think, Mr. Graham, that I have anything more to say at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pearson. We are now going to have Ken Kane, who is the director of the communications section of the Council for Yukon Indians. And he is not going to be talking about the claims negotiations process from the point of view of the Council for Yukon Indians. He's going to be talking about the exercise of communicating what is going on there to the band level, to the community level, within the Native community. Ken?
Thank you very much. Like Garth said, my name is Ken Kane. I work in the communication department for the Council for Yukon Indians. Although I work for CYI and fairly close to the negotiating process, I am not one of the person that actually sit down on the negotiating table. I'm the person that puts the news release out and tell you what happens at the negotiating table. Well, what I will talk about is still the process, even though I know like tonight is the process of negotiation from the point of view of those people sitting at the negotiating table, but what I think is also important is the process that was carried out by our people and by CYI, the community process, the whole communication process that happened so that our people could sit at those tables with direction from the people in the communities. If you know our constitution at all, in May of 76, a change occurred in the structure of the organization called Council for Yukon Indians. The main aspect of this change, I guess, was the reuniting of Council for Yukon Indians with through the democratic process called General Assembly with the people in the communities. Our first mandate was from the General Assembly was to make sure our people, the community awareness, educational thing that has to go on before, so that people can know what happens. People know what's going on. So, like I said, keeping in line that more responsibility and greater involvement, greater community involvement in the affairs of CYI was needed. One of the first things they did was create a communication department. And the first job of this communication department was to hold elections after the reorganization in 76. As you understand, the new constitution provided that the communities recognized by CYI, which is 12, we have 12 recognized communities in the Yukon, were to conduct their own elections to elect their own General Assembly, Board of Directors, to this General Assembly in CYI. So the first job of CYI communication was holding this election of five elected members from each area to sit on what we call a General Assembly. One of which of these five members then assumes or is picked to be a board member. Well, around August of last year, all communities had their elections, had their General Assembly members in place. And this was accomplished by not only CY, but I think a combined effort of Yancey and YNB at the beginning to start this whole process of awareness of our people in the communities, so that we, the importance, I guess, of being involved and aware were stressed to our people. So as last summer progressed into fall, we realized that the role of communication was not just one of taking information and sending it out and just receiving and dispensing information, but we realized that we had to start playing a key role in unifying our people. As Mr. Greiber pointed out, like, the number one item on our claim is eligibility, where I guess we're telling the government that as Indian people, we know who we are. We don't have to, we don't go along those lines of saying that you're status and I'm status and you're not non-status. So I guess the whole unity of the process that went on there is having a key place. We realized that communication had to be more than just sending and keeping our people informed, but having a key place in getting our people organized and unified. And also at the same time to make sure that our people knew what was going on in the main office in CYI. So the way we done this is we realized we had 12 communities to work with, and we started off with having or hiring or choosing contact people in each area and opening land claims office so that we could have a direct link to each area. The channel open for questions and whatever it is that the community people want, a direct line into CYI. So one of the first things we did was choose contacts and open up land claims office. After that, we realized that our people, because the only tool that is provided to the communities is one radio, and that's CBC, we realized that a lot of our people, because they can't understand English and they don't really listen to radio that much, that another tactic had to be applied in sort of getting the story of land claims to our people so that they could understand it first. So the process that went on was a series of workshops was initiated by CYI last January, around the same time the planning process were sitting down. So workshops were held in each community, week-long workshops where the communication staff informed the people of various issues. The tools and the resources that we used were, we printed two books, like booklet number one, booklet number two, and we acquired some video equipment, and I guess just various other tools like bumper stickers. You've probably seen them around, posters and buttons and things. This whole process of awareness happened the last, I'd say, about a year since since I started. But the resources we used, and I think another important tool was that we utilize and Yukon Indian News, which goes into each of our communities, was an important tool we realized, and we started utilizing, and we have what we call supplements in there, just dealing mainly with CY activity. Okay, after this whole process was initiated of contacts and land claims office, we realized that even though our mandate from the CYI, keeping in view our mandate from CYI to have our people and the communities educated firstly, I guess, on the claims, we realized that it was very important that we tell the story, the CYI story, the land claim story, to the non-Indian people, not only in the north here, but also in the south. So, along with Hugh McCollum, a project, he works for a project he calls Project North, we initiate what we call the Southern Support System, which is in each province in the state, I mean in the south, and also up here, what we've done is we've have organized or gotten together with people down there that form what we call a Southern Support Group nationally, because that are also help telling people down south about the things that are going on in the Yukon, and also to more or less tell our story of land claims. And we also realized too that much of the power that at an early stage, we realized that much of the power, the political power in this country, lies down south. That was another reason for making sure that we have Southern support to make sure that when it comes down to negotiating, that we have people that see our point of view also down south. Up until all these things were in place up until about, first we had contact workers, land claims office, and then around July and August of this last year, to get more community involvement, to make sure that people in the communities are represented in CYI, the role of the contact, and along with each area, more or less took on a change. A change was what we called decentralization. What that is primarily that each area, the 12 recognized communities, began drawing up budgets and job descriptions to become more self-sufficient, to start running the more to start taking care of more of the problems that are relayed to the main office here. Some of those problems could be taken care of with the communities, we realize. So a process called decentralization was sort of more or less introduced. Along with that, this decentralization, was this process called community council and community negotiators. Around September of this year, after the whole process of decentralization happened in the communities, around September at our last General Assembly, another change occurred in our Constitution. On September 1977, the Constitution was changed once more. It now provides that a yearly Yukon-wide election be held in which all Indian people 16 years of age or over can vote and run for the position of the chairman, the vice chairman, and secretary treasurer. The purpose of this new approach was to make CYI more responsible and more democratic as possible so that more people in the communities can have a say on the affairs of CYI at the head office, I believe, is where the motion that was passed to change the Constitution. And then recently, what has happened in the communities is we've gotten more, starting with the decentralization, we're trying to more and more to lay the power, I guess, of the organization with the people in the communities. So what we've done is initiated or help the community start what we call community councils in each area. What that is primarily a council in the community made of of non-status groups that are in the community, and the status groups, the elders. And this council is responsible or has the say in land claims. When you think about land claims being settled, when you look at our constitution states that CYI, we don't have no power to sign anything. Like, the power has to come from the people. We don't have no signing power. All we do is we help negotiate and try to settle our claims. But keeping that in mind, we decided to, that we would help the communities in forming like these community councils, which would consist of all the various people that are going to participate in the claim in the community. And out of this council grew what we call 12 negotiators. Each community picked their own negotiators, and the duties of these negotiators were to work for that community and to put together claims for that community. Along with Dave Joe, who is the head negotiator here in Whitehorse. So I think the thing that, more or less to kind of wrap the community process up here, I'd like to say is that in a year and a half, I've seen my people come awake tremendously. A unique process is happening. People are finding out new things about this 20th century world here. And the Yukon Indian people, I believe, are rediscovering themselves. I mean, I know that we are a proud people, you know, and that want to stand on our feet and control our own destinies. I think the guiding principle that I've tried to communicate, working in communication, has always been one of that the Yukon Indians are not the enemies, or do we consider non-enemy, vice versa up here. I think it's time that we stop looking at things in along those terms. But I think it's these outside forces that are trying to control our destiny up here. But I'd just like to say that I think, you know, given the tools of this modern white society and combining these with some of our traditional Indian know-how, knowledge and values that we have, I know we can become productive. I think what we're asking in land claims, I think one of the things we're going to ask in land claims is that the reason we're asking for land claims before pipelines and other development, I guess, is believe that we see land claims as really the beginning of regaining some of the control that have been taken away from us. The right to choose and to act on our choices. And I think, like I said, the guiding principle that I've always wanted to communicate, and I'm sure since reorganization, people that have been following land claims in CY and Yukon Native Brotherhood since 68, I will say that a change did happen, not only in the Constitution in 76. I think that change was the opening of doors, not only from our side over there, but a little more from the other side too, of being more open and telling people that we are not the enemy, and nor do we consider you guys the enemy.